Let's start with our motivation and recalling the kindness of other beings, not only friends but also strangers, and also the people who have caused us difficulties, how they have made us grow and find internal resources that we didn't know we had through the difficulties they've caused us. And by thinking in that way, let's release our resentment towards them. And remembering that everybody wants happiness and not suffering. And that they're all just like us in wanting that. Then let's cultivate a heart of kindness and of compassion that wants them to be happy. And a mind of courage that is willing to act in order to bring about their welfare. And to do that, a mind that aspires for full enlightenment, so we will have the greatest capacity to be of the greatest benefit to all living beings. So let's cultivate that as our motivation for listening to the Dharma talk this evening. So you may never have thought about it before, that the people who harm us have been kind to us. We usually think, those people have been mean, and I have every right in the world to wish them, suffering. And yet if you think about it, we always somehow manage to pull through those difficulties, don't we? There might have been some suffering or some challenges or difficulties, but we always manage to pull through. And in the process of pulling through, we've had to develop ourselves and tap into internal resources that we didn't know we had, or resources that were underdeveloped until then. So we come out stronger from the difficulties. And so when we really see that and how we grow and the kindness of the people who harm us for creating the situations in which we can grow, then we put our palms together and say, thank you very much. Possible or impossible? Possible. Yeah. Huh?
Difficult.
Yeah. Difficult, okay. But it's not impossible. And can you see the logic in it? Can you see how, looking at the situation in one way, it's really true? That you come out much stronger through having gone through difficulties? And so in that way, rather than hold a grudge or hold on to resentment or have, when we think about a certain thing in our life, just have this completely shadow, and fear come up or dread, rather than that, just, to be able to make peace with it and say, I learned something that was useful. Yeah. And often it's really the difficulties that we go through that help us to learn. Some of you are still chewing on that. You don't look entirely convinced. But think about it. Yeah, think about it some. Yeah. And we have a choice. We can hold on to a grudge and hold on to resentment. We have free will. We're entitled to hold on to resentment and grudges and hate people. But do you really want to do that? Is that really going to make you happy? No, it's not going to make us happy. So really letting go of the grudges and developing some kindness is something we do to benefit ourselves, so we can have some peace of mind. Okay, so we're going to be talking about the bodhisattvas this evening. Some of you are just coming for the first time. We've been talking about how people progress along the Mahayana path, and we're talking about the fourth ground bodhisattvas who are on the path of meditation. So these are beings who have what I just described. For them, that's just their way of seeing things. You know, somebody hurts them and they think, oh good, now I have a chance to practice fortitude. They don't go, get me away from this creep. They go, oh good, now I have a chance to practice. So, you know, this is the kind of attitude that we want to develop. And when we develop these kinds of attitudes, then, you know, we cultivate the bodhisattva qualities, and we're able to, you know, achieve the things that we're going to read about this evening in talking about the different grounds of the bodhisattvas. Okay, so when we were talking last week about the third ground bodhisattvas, we were saying how they develop a very deep kind of meditative stabilization, and so that they can actualize, well, they've probably already actualized the five super knowledges, special paranormal powers, and how now they really can do these quite well. And if you're a bodhisattva, having these super knowledges increases your ability to be a benefit to sentient beings. Okay, so if you have supernormal powers, you can walk on water, go through the earth, you know, transform your body very big or very small, or make multiple bodies out of one body and one body out of multiple bodies, and make yourself invisible and things like that. If you have that kind of ability, it's going to enable you to be of greater benefit to living beings, because you can manifest in different ways that can benefit. Similarly, if you have the divine ear, if you can hear sounds a long way away, you can hear what's going on with other people and know who needs help. You can also hear Dharma teachings, even, you know, when you're far away. With the ability to understand others' minds and know a mind with attachment as having attachment, a mind with concentration as having concentration, then you know the levels of spiritual cultivation of different sentient beings. And so with a wish to be able to benefit them, you know what to teach them. Yeah? So it makes it easy. If you have the ability to recollect past lives, then you know which sentient beings you have some kind of karmic connection with, so which ones it's going to be easy to benefit. If you have the divine eye, which knows things far away and knows, you know, can see living beings dying and being reborn according to their karma, then again, that's going to help you benefit sentient beings, because you have much more information about them, and you'll know, you know, again, how to lead them and what karma they have and what they need to learn and so on and so forth. So these kind of powers come through developing samadhi and very deep levels of concentration. So ordinary beings can develop those levels of samadhi, but then also often they become quite arrogant when they have them. And so instead of creating good karma, they use those abilities to create negative karma. So here we're talking about these powers, especially within the context of the bodhisattva path, where as a bodhisattva, when you really care about others, you want to benefit them, then you want to develop these abilities, because it just gives you more ability to be of greater and greater benefit to living beings. Okay? So we were talking about that last week with the third ground. So now with the fourth ground, it's called the radiant, And it too has four parts. We've been talking about these four parts with all the different grounds. So the first one is the mode of achieving the qualities on the fourth ground. So remember those 12 sets of qualities? You know, like going to pure lands and making different manifestations and listening to teachings and so on. So on this ground, one achieves the 12 sets of qualities explained previously, 1 trillion times, you know, 1 trillion fold. Okay, here it says 110 million, but that works out to be a trillion. Okay, so you can really see how from starting out on the, the first bhumi, you have 100 of those qualities, and then the second 1,000, and the third, I think you had 100,000, and now you have 1 trillion. So, you know, the mind's much more powerful now. Then the second outline was the mode of achieving majesty of power on the fourth ground. And so that's how you develop the strength in your wisdom to be able to overcome subtler and subtler levels of obscuration. So it says, in subsequent attainment, one amasses the collection of merit for the sake of abandoning the grade of the middling afflictive obscurations to be abandoned on a path of meditation. Seeing the signs of being able to abandon those, one enters into meditative equipoise on emptiness. Thereby, one meditative consciousness becomes an actual antidote to those obstructions, and one is able to move to the fifth ground. So this is what we described before, okay? How that bodhisattva practices and accumulates merit on the fourth ground, then they... you know, when they're meditating on emptiness, then they feel like, oh, it's getting powerful. I'm going to soon be able to free myself from the next level of obscurations. So then they enter into the uninterrupted path, which, you know, has eliminated that level of obscuration, and then the liberated path in which they have been totally abandoned. And in that way, you go up to the fifth ground. You progress from the fourth to the fifth ground. Okay, and then the third outline is the mode of surpassing practice of a perfection on the fourth ground. So on this ground, destroying manifest occasions of the three lazinesses, whether awake or dreaming, one achieves a surpassing practice of the perfection effort. Okay, what are the three kinds of laziness?
Busyness with worldly concern.
Okay. What's the first one in order?
Sloth,
hanging out, sleeping too much. Yeah, la mañana, I'll get around to it, maybe. Okay. Then the second kind of laziness? Being extremely busy with worldly things. You know, you have to go to this movie and you have to have that hobby and be out with these friends and catch up on Facebook with what everybody's doing, and you're the busiest of the busy. Okay, and then the third kind of laziness?
Discouragement.
Okay, so when we're discouraged and we're depressed, it's actually a form of laziness. Oh, I'm hopeless. I can never do it. This is just too hard. I'm inferior. Yeah, I think I'll suck my thumb. Yeah, so that's all a form of laziness, because here, you know, we're talking about laziness in terms of practicing the Dharma. So that's why keeping ourselves very busy in worldly ways is considered a practice of laziness in the context of the Dharma, because when we're very busy doing worldly things, we have no time for the Dharma. Similarly, when we're busy being discouraged, we have no time for the Dharma. We're too busy feeling sorry for ourselves and blaming the world for our problems. Right? We did some good skits about that. You were really good last time with that one. You have to do a rerun of that. What was that? With Frieda Freud? Yeah, you were Frieda Freud, and she was the... Yeah.
The self-centered thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
But seriously discouraged.
Yeah, seriously discouraged. Okay. And then the fourth one is the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the fourth ground. So this is the kind of rebirth that this bodhisattva can take in order to benefit sentient beings. So having taken birth as lord of the land without combat, one affects the welfare of sentient beings. Okay, so the war without combat. Which one is that?
Hmm?
Land without combat. Okay, so this is, I've got to have a different translation here. Let me just look, because sometimes these things have to. The third ground was your chakra, right? Okay. And what was the second ground? Second ground, you were Chakravartinki, right? Okay, so I think, because these ones have different names, but there's six kinds of desire realm gods. So the way I have the names listed is the devas of the four great kings, then the god realm of the 33, which I think is the one that Chakra is king of. Then the third one is the Yama devas, so that might be this one. Okay. The fourth one is Tushita, the land of joy, but it's not the Tushita that Lama Tsongkhapa lives in. He lives in a suburb of this Tushita. That is a gated community only for bodhisattvas. The fifth desire realm god is called the Devas Delighting in Emanation, and the sixth one is the Controller of Others' Emanations. So we'll come across these, but that's just the name. So I have a feeling that this is another name for what I have here is the Yama Devas. Okay? And without comment. Okay, then we go on to Nagarjuna's quotation from the Precious Garland. Okay, the fourth is called the Radiant, because the light of true wisdom arises, in which the bodhisattva cultivates supremely all the harmonies with enlightenment. Okay, so in this verse, when it's talking about the light of true wisdom arises, so here the wisdom arises due to very intense cultivation of the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, which is also sometimes translated as the 37 wings of enlightenment or 37 branches of enlightenment. So these 37 are kind of the principal practices that you do, whether you're on the practices you do and qualities you develop, whether you're on the disciple path, the solitary realizer, the bodhisattva path. Okay, so they come in seven sets, these 37. So there's the four establishments of mindfulness. So those are the mindfulnesses of body, feeling, mind, and phenomena. And then the four strivings. So those are all types of effort. So one is generating virtuous qualities that you haven't yet generated. The second is increasing those you have generated. The third is not generating the non-virtuous qualities you haven't already generated. And the one is abandoning the fourth one is abandoning ones you have generated. Okay. And then the four, the next set is called the four bases of spiritual powers. The Tibetans call it the four legs of manifestation. So these are all states of concentration in which you can emanate bodies and have very deep kinds of concentration. So they're the concentrations of aspiration, effort, intention, and concentration. No, and analysis, sorry. Okay, so aspiration, effort, intention, and analysis. Then you have the five faculties, which are different qualities that you're developing as you're meditating. So faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And those are able to oppose their opposites, which would be, you know, having not having faith, laziness, lack of mindfulness, distraction in your meditation, and, you know, ignorance, wrong views. And when those five faculties become very, very strong and they can really eliminate their opposites, then they become known as the five powers, which is another set. Okay? And then the sixth set is called the seven enlightenment factors. So that's correct mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, effort, joy, effort, rapture, pliancy, concentration, and equanimity. So that helps you really refine your concentration so you can unite it with insight. And then the last set is the Eightfold Noble Path. So right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Okay, so you have those seven sets. And then altogether they comprise these 37 practices and qualities that you're trying to do. So we did a whole series on the four establishments of mindfulness before, because on the Bodhisattva path, when you're practicing it according to Sutrayana or Paramitayana, then, you know, you really practice those same four establishments of mindfulness. That's your basic foundation, and then you develop all these other qualities on the basis of that, and by going deeper and deeper into the four establishments of mindfulness. And, you know, when you're on the Bodhisattva path, then you do that practice with bodhicitta, the motivation of bodhicitta. And when it comes to meditating on the wisdom aspect of those practices, you do it with the prasangika view. Okay? Then the second verse from Nagarjuna, it says, through the maturation of these qualities, the bodhisattva becomes a kind of the gods in the land without combat. So, you know, can take birth in that land. He or she is skilled in quelling the arising of the view that the transitory collection is a real self. Okay? So transitory collection, that's another English terminology for view of personal identity. So this bodhisattva is very skilled in subduing that view that there's a real I and me and mine. Okay, wouldn't that be nice to subdue that view and not have this I popping up all day long saying, I want this, I think that, things ought to be the way I want them. So to have, you know, such a solid concrete I, that wisdom that opposes that. So there is a reason for calling this ground the radiant, because on this ground, in dependence upon specially cultivating the subtle and coarse forms of the 37 harmonies with enlightenment and meditative equipoise, in subsequent attainment there arises an appearance of light surpassing that of the former ground, whereby it is called such. Clear? One sentence paragraph. Yeah? Everybody's been reading this text has seen how Tibetan sentences are paragraphs, actually. Okay, so there's a reason why this ground, the fourth ground, is called the radiant. Okay, the reason is on that ground, you're especially cultivating the subtle and coarse forms of these 37 wings or 37 harmonies with enlightenment. So the coarse form is going to be based on the eliminating the view of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, and the subtle form is eliminating the view of an inherently existent person. Okay, so that's what they're meditating on in their meditative equipoise. know, not only doing these practices, but seeing the emptiness of them. And because of that, in subsequent attainment, when they come out of their meditative equipoise and emptiness, there arises an appearance of light, unlike what that was on the previous ground. So I think it's, you know, because they have this kind of wisdom, there's some appearance of light. Don't ask me more than that. I don't know if it means that they're shining or if they see an appearance of light or if it's a metaphor. Definitely it's a metaphor for the state of mind, you know, because it has the light of wisdom. But in any case, it's called the radiant. And then Maitreya's ornament for Mahayana Sutras says, because of possessing factors harmonious with enlightenment, burning forth like light, this ground burns away the two, whereby it is called the radiant. Okay, so there you see the metaphor more clearly. Yeah, that the wisdom is burning forth like light, and because of that it's able to burn away the obstacles of that ground. And Nagarjuna's praise of the element of qualities says, this ground, due to being illuminated by the light of constant virtue and encircled by the light of the exalted wisdom that has abandoned commotion, is asserted as the radiant. Okay, so here the light is the light of constant virtue and also the light of wisdom that abandons commotion. But we like commotion, don't we? Yeah? Don't you feel kind of alive when there's a lot of commotion? Yeah?
In this quote from Maitreya's ornament, so the two is referring to the subtle and coarse forms? Or what is that two? This ground burns away the two.
Whereby it is called. Yeah, I would think so. Oh, what does it say? Yes, the subtle and coarse forms of the view of a personal identity as a real I and mine. Okay. Then there's something just to talk about these different bhumis that we're going through and the perfections, you know, or the far-reaching practices on them. So the first bhumi is called the basis of the training, and there you're really perfecting generosity. So generosity is like the basis of your training. The second bhumi corresponds to the higher training in ethical conduct, and there you're perfecting the far-reaching practice of ethical conduct. The third bhumi corresponds with the higher training in concentration, and that's the one where you're developing those deep concentrations and can gain the super knowledges in that special way. And then the fourth to the sixth bhumis, or grounds of a bodhisattva, correspond to the higher training of wisdom. So in the fourth one here, the special practice was the 37 harmonies with enlightenment. In the next one, the fifth one, it's going to be the Four Noble Truths. And then in the sixth one, it's going to be the 12 links of dependent origin. So really developing special wisdom about those particular teachings. Okay? We're talking about those as how they correspond with the three higher trainings. Okay. Yeah. So we're not, you know, there's some overlap with the far-reaching practices, but it's really talking about the three higher trainings. Ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, then we're moving. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Uh-huh. This thing about completely burning away the two, the view of personal identity.
Yeah.
This is kind of the same problem that we talked about.
Right.
So it's getting more subtly confusing.
Yeah. But because what you, when you're reading these, you know, it's like we expect it all to.
Line up.
And it doesn't, you know. It's like, okay, because actually you eliminated the acquired level of this one on the on the first bhumi, yeah, which was the path of seeing, you know, but then it says later on that, you know, you've eliminated it here and there, but it's really referring to the subtle, to the coarse form of it and not the subtle form. And so it's the same kind of thing here, because you don't fully eliminate this one until the beginning of the eighth ground.
Okay.
So, you know, when you see that, it's indicating that, you know, again, they're getting a special power and ability to subdue that. Okay, it hasn't been fully eliminated. Otherwise, you're going to fully eliminate something many times, which doesn't make any sense. Okay, so the fifth ground, the explanation of the fifth ground, which is called the difficult to overcome, has four parts. So it's called difficult to overcome because the Maras can't conquer it. And the reason the Maras can't conquer is because that bodhisattva really knows the subtle meaning of the Four Noble Truths. Okay. Do you know the different kinds of Maras? Okay. Let's see if I can remember them. The Mara of death. The Mara of the aggregates. No, and then I think it's the Mara of ignorance. Must be. No, the Mara of afflictions. Of afflictions. And then the fourth one is some kind of capricious Cupid like deva that causes problems. Or another way of saying it, it's a Mara of arrogance. Yeah, getting arrogant about your spiritual attainments. Okay, so the first one here, the mode of achieving qualities in the fifth ground. So on this ground, one achieves the 12 sets of good qualities explained previously 10 trillion times. Okay. So you can really see when you think about it, you know, what these bodhisattvas do. It's really quite amazing, isn't it? And then the mode of achieving majesty of power on the fifth ground. So it's like before, in the subsequent attainment, one amasses the collection of merit for the sake of abandoning the middling of the middling afflictive obstructions to be abandoned by a path of meditation. Seeing signs of being able to do that, one sets in meditative equipoise, and thereby one meditative consciousness, you know, in one session, becomes an actual antidote to those obstructions, in other words, the liberated path, and one is able to move to the sixth ground. Okay. Well, actually, actual antidote. Well, both, I think, are uninterrupted and liberated, are antidotes to the obstructions. Then the third outline, the mode of surpassing practice of a perfection on the fifth ground. So on this ground, the force of one destroying the possibility of becoming distracted in either a waking or dreaming state, and two, becoming skilled in the coarse and subtle forms of the Four Noble Truths, one achieves a greatly surpassing practice of the far-reaching concentration. Okay? So that's the far-reaching practice on this one. You know, fifth ground, fifth far-reaching practice of concentration. So you've destroyed the possibility of becoming distracted in either waking or dreaming state, which means that you can take your samadhi with you when you go to sleep. You know, we just completely are gone when we go to sleep, aren't we? You know, totally unaware of what's going on. So this bodhisattva still has their single-pointed concentration, and they're skilled in the coarse and subtle forms of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so then the fourth outline, the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the fifth ground. So having taken rebirth as a lord of the joyous heaven, so that's Tushita, that's the fourth desire realm god, one furthers the welfare of sentient beings. Yeah, and Nagarjuna's precious garland says, the fifth is called the extremely difficult to overcome. Since all evil ones, that means Maras, find it extremely hard to conquer a bodhisattva on the fifth ground. he or she becomes skilled in knowing the subtle meanings of the noble truths and so forth. Okay, so when somebody really knows the subtle meanings of the Four Noble Truths and can see the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths very clearly, the subtle emptiness of the Four Noble Truths, then it's very difficult for any kind of wrong view or samsaric circumstance to overcome them. Okay, so the maras of death, affliction, what is it, the five aggregates, and then this God. Yeah. Okay, so difficult to be overcome by those. Yeah. Through the maturation of these qualities, the bodhisattva becomes a king of the gods abiding in the joyous land. Joyous land is a translation for Tushita. The Tibetan is Dewachen. One overcomes the sources of afflictions and of the views of all forders. Forders refers to the non-Buddhists. Dewachen. I think Jewa Chen is Sukhavati, actually. So what's Tushita? Oh, Gadan Lage. Yeah, Gadan. Gadan is Tushita. When we're doing, because we're going to do the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, Gadan Lage Ma, the 100 gods of Gadan. Okay? So Gadan's the Tibetan word for Tushita. Dewa Chen is the one for Sukhavati. Okay. So there is a reason for calling this ground the difficult to overcome, because the abandoning of faults and taking up of good qualities done on this ground are very difficult even for bodhisattvas. Okay. And it is difficult even for devils, you know, or maras such as Garab Wangchuk to overcome this bodhisattva, due to which it is called the difficult to overcome. So attaining the kinds of concentration and wisdom are difficult to do, but having done that, you know, other negative forces can't overcome the power of that bodhisattva's mind. Her name is Maitri, which is Maitreya, who also lives in Tushita. That's where Maitreya is going to be the next, it's prophesied to be the next Buddha. So he's in Tushita, heaven, the suburb of Tushita, until coming down and turning the Dharma wheel. So she heard. Okay, so Maitreya's ornament for Mahayana Sutras says, because one ripens well all living beings and also guards one's own mind, it is difficult to be conquered even by the intelligent. Therefore, it is called the difficult to conquer. Okay, so here this bodhisattva has a special ability to ripen the minds of other sentient beings. So what does it mean to ripen somebody's mind? You know, do you put it out in the sun like a pear, so the pear ripens? Yeah. Yeah, you give them the appropriate teachings and you lead them in such a way so that their mind becomes very receptive and their previously created good karma potential to gain further understandings can come out at that time. Okay? So the when somebody's very closed-minded, the Tibetans call it lepjango, which means green brain. Yeah, like a green fruit is unripe. Yeah, so somebody's closed-minded is like they have a unripe way of thinking, yeah? So when you ripen sentient beings by teaching them, by guiding them, giving them different practices to do, to purify or to create merit, these kinds of things, then you ripen their mind, and then you can give them further teachings and they can do more meditation and they can really advance. Okay? So this bodhisattva can ripen well the minds of living beings and also guard their own mind. So very strong mindfulness which remembers their precepts and what they're going to practice, and very strong introspective awareness, which checks up and sees what's going on in the mind at any particular time, so that the mind can stay on what you place it on. And then Nagarjuna's praise of the element of qualities says, since the Bodhisattva on the fifth ground has all the knowledges and arts, the various aspects of concentrations, and has conquered afflictions very difficult to overcome, this ground is called the difficult to conquer. Okay, so knowing the knowledges and the arts and having those concentrations are probably some of the things that it's difficult for that Bodhisattva to develop. Yeah, but due to it, then, and they've, you know, they're difficult to conquer. So those Bodhisattvas on the fifth ground have a special understanding of the fourth, for the Four Noble Truths, the gross, the coarse and subtle forms of them, and also the two truths. Okay, because the two truths fit into the Four Noble Truths. How do they do that? Which of the Four Noble Truths are conventional truths and which are ultimate truths? The first two are the conventional. The first, then the four. Okay, conventional. First two. First. Then the cessations are ultimate, and then the path, I guess, is the conventional. Wait, wait, let's go through it. The first one, the truth of dukkha is? Conventional. It's a conventional truth. The truth of the origin? Conventional. Is a conventional truth. The truth of cessation?
Ultimate
truth. The truth of the path?
Conventional.
Conventional. Because remember, ultimate truths are only emptinesses. A path is a consciousness.
Yeah.
So it's a conventional truth. Okay? So this Bodhisattva really understands how the four truths and the two truths fit together. You know, how we always screw up our face when we hear that true cessation is an ultimate truth, because I thought emptiness was, but true cessation is the emptiness of a mind that has the emptiness of a mind that has purified some degree of afflictions. You know, we say, how can that be a true cessation? How can a true cessation be an emptiness? So this Bodhisattva understands all of that. From their own experience.
Yeah.
We're just trying to get it intellectually.
Well, what does coarse and subtle mean as applied to the Four Noble Truths?
Again, the whether it's you know, whether the true origin is grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. The true dukkha is the dukkha caused by that grasping. The true path is what overcomes that grasping. That true cessation, you know.
Okay.
So it's really only the subtle aspects of the Four Noble Truths that are really the actual ones. Because true cessation, yeah, the coarse true cessation is still a conventional truth. Because it's not an emptiness of true existence.
Right. So it's not, how can it even be a cessation?
Because it's ceasing those levels of afflictions that are dependent upon the grasping at self-sufficient, substantially existent person.
Okay.
Okay, we're speeding along here to the sixth ground. Yeah, so the explanation of the sixth ground, the manifest, has four parts. So the mode of achieving qualities on the sixth ground. So on this ground, one achieves the 12 sets of these good qualities 100 trillion times, 100 trillion manifold of these 12 qualities. And the mode of achieving majesty of power on the sixth ground, on the occasion of the exalted wisdom of subsequent attainment, one amasses the collection of merit for the sake of being able to abandon the small of the middling afflictions, which are abandoned by a path of meditation. Seeing signs of being able to abandon them, one sets in meditative equipoise on emptiness, Thereby, one meditative consciousness, means in one meditative session, becomes an actual antidote to those afflictions, and one is able to move to the seventh ground. Okay, so the mode of surpassing practice of a far-reaching practice on the sixth ground. On this ground, through the force of destroying obscurations of view with respect to suchness in both waking and sleeping states, and becoming skilled in suchness, that is to say, the profound dependent arising, one newly achieves an uncommon absorption of cessation, whereby one achieves a surpassing practice of the perfection of wisdom. Okay? Clear? Okay, so on this ground, through the force of destroying the obscuration of view with respect to suchness. Okay, so any obscurations that, you know, remain with respect to suchness. Suchness means emptiness. Okay, so obscurations with respect to that view, anything that's obscuring that view, in both the waking and the sleeping states. Okay, so when you're awake, you know, and when you're asleep, you don't have any obscurations to your view of emptiness. This mind is able to overcome those. Sounds good, huh? Sounds quite amazing, actually. Imagine being able to do that when you're sleeping. Yeah, hard to do when you're awake, but when you're sleeping, no obscurations about your view of emptiness. Okay. So, and becoming skilled in suchness, which means you really are familiar with the meaning of emptiness. Okay. And here it has suchness, that is to say, the profound dependent arising. So the author here is saying that emptiness and dependent arising come to the same point. So when you fully understand emptiness, you also fully understand dependent arising, and you see that the two are complementary and not contradictory. And that's a very special quality that Jason Kampfa really emphasizes. Yeah? And that the better you understand emptiness, the better you understand dependent arising, and vice versa. So that's what I was saying this morning when I was saying about teachers who have the right view, then they have a good understanding of emptiness, but they can also establish the functioning of cause and effect on the conventional level because they understand dependent arising. So that whole thing is quite important. Okay? We chant the three principal aspects of the path. Yeah, and that last section, he talks quite a bit about this, you know, because one who has gained the view of dependent arising has entered the path which pleases the Buddha, but only when you see the two as complementary, yeah, and when you see, whenever you have thought or see any dependent arising, automatically you think of its emptiness. Pretty incredible. Then you have the real view, the culmination of the view. Okay, so somebody has that skill in emptiness and independent arising, and they newly achieve an uncommon absorption of cessation. Okay, so remember before when I was talking about the eight complete liberations, the last one was this absorption of cessation, and there were two kinds of it. Yeah, you asked this question, remember, from the last quiz? Yeah? Oh, yeah. Okay, so the absorption of cessation is kind of the when all the discrimination and feeling in the, you know, those mental factors in the mind cease, which basically what it is it's all the gross mental functions of the mind temporarily cease. Okay, so that's the common absorption of cessation. And then the uncommon absorption of cessation is when you know, those gross mental functions of the mind cease, and within that, you meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence. So that's really something, to be able to do that. Quite difficult to do. And so when you can do that, then one achieves a surpassing practice of far-reaching wisdom. Okay, so you can see why that's a surpassing practice if a bodhisattva can do that. And then the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the sixth ground. So having taken rebirth as a lord of the land of enjoying emanation, so that's the fifth of the six desire realm gods, one furthers the welfare of sentient beings. So that's the rebirth one takes to really work for the benefit of sentient beings. In addition, one can emanate all those different manifestations to help different sentient beings. And then Nagarjuna's precious garland says, the sixth is called the approaching because the bodhisattva is approaching the qualities of a Buddha. Isn't that nice? There's 10 bhumis, but on the sixth you're called the approaching because you're approaching the qualities of a Buddha. Through familiarity with serenity and insight, he or she attains cessation and is thus advanced in wisdom. So here that cessation refers to the uncommon absorption of cessation. It doesn't mean full, you know, this bodhisattva has been attaining different true cessations all along. Yeah, but here it's referring to that cessation. Through the maturation of these qualities, the bodhisattva becomes a king of the gods in the land of enjoying emanation. Hearers cannot surpass one. Those with the pride of superiority are pacified. Okay, so because this bodhisattva has such incredible wisdom and ability to manifest like this, then those following the hearer disciple path cannot surpass that person. And those with the pride of superiority are pacified. So any kind of devas or any living being, it could be Buddhist or non-Buddhist, who is quite arrogant, when they come in contact with this kind of bodhisattva and see their great qualities, then their own inflated arrogance and conceit goes, you know. So there's a reason for calling this ground the approaching or the manifest, because through meditating on dependent arising according to the forward system and the reverse system, one manifests realization of the emptiness of true existence, of cyclic existence and nirvana, and is approaching manifestly the qualities of a Buddha, due to which it is called the approaching. Okay, so that what means, you know, why is this called the approaching or the manifest? So this bodhisattva, when we talk of the 12 links of dependent origination, you know, you can meditate on the forward system. Ignorance leads to formative actions, to consciousness, et cetera, to birth and then aging and death. Or the reverse system. Where do aging and death come from? From birth. Where does birth come from? From renewed existence. Where does that come from? From clinging, from craving, and you trace it backward. That's the reverse system. So if you're skilled in this special wisdom of seeing how one thing leads to another and how one thing is a result of another, and not only that, seeing how that causes, explains the cause of samsara, but also understanding that when you eliminate ignorance, then you eliminate formative actions, then you eliminate consciousness and so on. And then the reverse of that, that when aging and death has been eliminated, it's because birth has been eliminated, which is because renewed existence has been eliminated and going backwards. Okay? So you have the forward and reverse cycles for both causing samsara and how samsara arises, and for how you cease samsara. So this bodhisattva has a special wisdom regarding these 12 links of dependent origination. Okay? So due to that, one manifests the realization of the emptiness of true existence, of cyclic existence and nirvana. So this bodhisattva knows very clearly that cyclic existence is empty of true existence and nirvana is empty of true existence. When we hear that there's no difference between samsara and nirvana, this is what it means, that they're both empty of inherent existence or true existence. Yeah. It's another way that people, you know, who don't understand make mistakes. Oh, samsara and nirvana are one, so I can do whatever I want because it's glorious nirvanic, you know, actions, but really they don't have a mind of nirvana, so they're creating causes for samsara. So when it talks about the unity of samsara and nirvana, it's referring to them both being empty of true existence, them having that same nature of emptiness. It's not referring to, on the conventional level, them being the same thing. Because on the conventional level, you know, if you're in samsara, you're definitely not in nirvana, and vice versa. Okay? And so that bodhisattva who has that special wisdom of the forward and reverse, an understanding of the 12 links of dependent origination in both how it causes samsara, how it gets you out of samsara, who has the understanding of the emptiness of both samsara and nirvana, okay, that bodhisattva is manifestly approaching the qualities of a Buddha. You can see why. So thus they're called the approaching or the manifest. And Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutra says, because of manifesting here realization, these two, cyclic existence and nirvana, as empty of true existence. Okay, so because of realizing manifestly, so one has the actual realization of cyclic existence and nirvana, those two being empty of true existence, in dependence upon the perfection of wisdom, yeah, so in dependence upon direct realization, it is asserted as the ground of the manifest. And Nagarjuna's praise of the element of qualities says, with respect to all three aspects of enlightenment, the all-inclusive marvel and the profound production and disintegration, this ground is asserted as the manifest. Now, I can't say that I understand what these are all referring to. The three aspects of enlightenment, my guess is that it's referring to wishlessness, signlessness, and emptiness, but I'm not sure. The all-inclusive marvel might be seeing the union of samsara and nirvana, and the profound production and disintegration. I think that's talking about how you enter samsara and how you get free of samsara. So that's referring to that understanding of the 12 links. This ground is asserted as the manifest. Okay.
Let's go.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So we've been talking for a year now about these mental qualities that are developed to this degree. What effect is that having on the body that the bodhisattva has?
Oh, okay. What effect does it have on the body? Well, first of all, like we've been reading, that bodhisattva is able to, they can do all these emanations, but the central body that they have, they can take these higher and higher levels of rebirth in the God realm.
So they're not dragging around this bag of bones and flesh?
No, not like this.
Then of course they would need to have the sleep that we need with this.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it isn't probably sleep.
Probably not.
And so this body that the bodhisattva has, they get this transformed body at the path of accumulation?
Well, no, not at a path of accumulation. Because path of accumulation, they're still in samsara.
Okay.
Okay? And they haven't realized emptiness, they may not even have the intellectual realization of emptiness. So none of that happens in the first two paths. The bodhisattvas of the path of seeing, some exceptional bodhisattvas, not all of them, can do a practice that brings about what's called a mental body. So it's a body that is the nature of mind. Other bodhisattvas don't receive a mental body until the eighth bhumi. Okay? So a special kind of body that certainly isn't going to have the aches and pains and stuff like that that we do. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Okay. So for those of you who are entering into this and are saying, what in the world was she talking about for the last hour? Don't worry about it. We're at, you know, at the ending pages of a text that we've been working on for quite some time now. Yeah. And so, you know, understanding this depends on understanding what happened earlier in the text. But just even hearing this, even if you don't understand it, you get some idea. You hear some terms, you get some idea of what bodhisattvas are meditating on, some idea of what they're doing, and at least you can see, you know, some way in which that practice goes far beyond, you know, our ordinary state of mind that is sitting there worrying about the economy, you know. But these bodhisattvas, their mind's in a totally different space, you know, so that they can really do so much benefit for sentient beings. So, you know, even if you get that kind of idea from listening to this, then when you take refuge in the Sangha, meaning, you know, the Arya bodhisattvas, you have, you know, some real trust and confidence in their ability to support you in your spiritual practice.